Game on, boyfriend.
Are you about to dispute my official ruling in the sacred tradition of nose goes?
Technically correct.
I should have known. She didn't like me. I don't think anybody likes you.
I like me.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Okay, the zone's not working. They're a little bit too good to cover man to man. And we can't shoot for shit.
On ESPN Las Vegas.
Hello, goalie controversy. Malcolm Subban coming for your job. We'll get to the Golden Knights winning their fourth straight game with Subban in net. Mike Grimala is going to join us from Fresno. UNLV plays a conference game today. It's December 4th. But we start with the possibility of the Raiders forcing UNLV to play at Sam Boyd Stadium next season. The Review Journal has an update on the issues between UNLV and the Raiders and UNLV's use of Allegiant Stadium. And it seems pretty petty. A little bit of a backstory. UNLV has had their non-conference schedule for 2020 done for a while. Arizona State and Louisiana Tech were done before the stadium was even a thought. The Cal
just
game.
A twinkle in Mark Davis's eye.
The Cal game was done after the stadium was conceptualized, but was done before the joint use agreement was signed with the Raiders that would allow UNLV to use Allegiant Stadium. So when UNLV and the Raiders sat down, they had to come to a, they had to sign a joint use agreement that basically laid out UNLV's rights in that stadium, because it is in effect the Raiders stadium and UNLV is a tenant of that stadium. So they got to agree to, all right, how exactly are we going about UNLV using this? How are they scheduling it? How, you know, do they get parking? Do they get a field? All that stuff. So when they sat down when they sat down to sign this joint use agreement, everyone knew UNLV had three non-conference games scheduled for the 2020 season. This was not a secret. Everyone knew this. Well, the Raiders, they only want UNLV to play two home non-conference games every year because the Raiders want to have as many money-making events at that stadium as they can to make money. So they're like, hey, you know, we only want you guys to have two so we can free up some other Saturdays to make money. It's understandable. But UNLV already had three games scheduled for 2020, so they had to figure something out. So the joint use agreement was written like this. UNLV shall have the right to schedule two non-conference games to be played at the stadium each season following the first UNLV season. So basically, after the first season, UNLV is allowed to play two home non-conference games. That was written in there because UNLV has three already scheduled for year one. So in year two and beyond, hey, you're allowed to have two. But according to the Review Journal, the Raiders are arguing that that sentence means UNLV doesn't get to play any non-conference games in year one because it says UNLV has the right to schedule two non-conference games after the first season. It doesn't actually say UNLV gets to play non-conference games in the first season. Now, there is a separate section of the joint use agreement says UNLV gets to play August 29th in the stadium, which is the Cal game. So there's a separate part that says they do get to play that game. But what the Raiders are arguing is, hey, this joint use agreement says you don't get any other non-conference games in year one. But when that was signed, the purpose of that sentence was to allow UNLV to play three home non-conference games in year one because they already had three home non-conference games scheduled for year one before they even sat down. So first off, UNLV deserves blame for this because UNLV agreed to this. That is a poorly written sentence that could force UNLV to play at Sam Boyd Stadium next year. So UNLV deserves blame for agreeing to this joint use agreement that had that poorly worded sentence in it. UNLV, they hired a law firm out of New York to help with this, and the Board of Regents who signed off of it. They all deserve blame for this because that's a poorly written sentence that could end up screwing UNLV out of games at Allegiant Stadium next year. But I don't think we should be overly critical of UNLV because this whole situation with the Raiders is supposed to be a friendly deal. Like, yes, UNLV's tenants, but like they're sort of supposed to be partners with the Raiders playing at Raider Stadium. So when you sit down to sign a joint use agreement, you're not expecting the Raiders to take every possible detail and use it against you. Like, had they been sitting down with their mortal enemies, then okay, you need to go over every single sentence and make sure there is nothing that could possibly be used against you. But they're not. They're sitting down in what's supposed to be a publicly funded stadium, a stadium that UNLV is supposed to play at. I don't think there's an expectation that, oh, the Raiders are going to use this against us any way possible. But apparently they are. And that's here. That's the problem, is the Raiders, it's simply bad faith negotiating on the Raiders' part. Technically, by the way the joint use agreement is written, it's perfectly fine for the Raiders to say, hey, you don't get to play those games here. That's not what our agreement says. But the actual meaning behind it from the Raiders is just crappy. Like, the way they're treating UNLV is just crappy right now. So that's the bigger problem. Now, the good news for UNLV is the stadium authority is the body that settles these types of disputes, and the stadium authority is a public body. So you would think a public body overseeing a public stadium would side with the public university. I don't know that we should expect that, but you would think there's some hope that that would happen. Like, common sense here is, hey, UNLV had these games scheduled. They're going to play these games here. Like, sorry. Like, they had them scheduled. This is what's going to happen. But they don't have to do that. So we'll see what happens. End of the day, though, even if UNLV is allowed to play all their games at Allegiant Stadium next year, even if UNLV is allowed to play all three non-conference games, whether the Raiders just say, all right, that's fine, we'll let you play them, or if the stadium authority says, all right, you guys get to play them, sorry, Raiders, like UNLV gets to play their home games, they've had them scheduled. Even if they get to play them there, this is a horrific sign for how UNLV is going to be treated in this stadium.
Yeah.
It's not finished. There's not been a game or an event there, and the Raiders are already taking a poorly worded sentence and saying, well, according to this, you don't get to play here at all next year.
I mean, oh man, if you'd have to be slightly concerned with like what is this going to do for like the people who are, their whole plan to go see the stadium was like, I bought UNLV season tickets so that I could go see.
Well, you'll still get five games. The first game, well, as long as the stadium's open on time, the first game against Cal is written into the joint use agreement as, yep, they get to play that game. And then the conference games are written into the agreement that, yes, they get to play their home conference games at the stadium. It's just the Arizona State and the Louisiana Tech non-conference games that the Raiders are saying, well, according to the joint use agreement, you have no rights to play those games at our stadium.
It just still feels kind of crappy to be like, hey, I locked in my season tickets so that
that's true
immediately and you're going back to Sam Boyd.
the good news for UNLV is that they sold most of their season tickets this year. Hey, if you buy season tickets this year, you're locked in for that same price next year, so UNLV can be like, well, we gave you the Sam Boyd price, here's Sam Boyd again. So it's kind of okay, but yeah, no, it is extremely crappy, like, especially because they sold, I can't remember what the number was, but they sold, you know, more season tickets this offseason because they said, hey, buy season tickets this year, we'll give you the same exact price next year at Allegiant Stadium. Like, they sold more on the premise of, hey, you'll get to go to Allegiant Stadium next year, and two of those games are possibly not going to be at Allegiant Stadium.
Is this, oh man, there's not going to be a refund or anything like that. Has there been any public outcry? I have not kept my finger to the pulse of this story.
I mean, do like 10 people on Twitter count as public outcry?
That's like, if my understanding of Twitter is correct, that's like representative of like 12,000.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there are people that are pretty annoyed that this is even a conversation, but I wouldn't call it public outcry. I don't think we'll see. We had this conversation last week. I don't know how much people are going to care about UNLV football getting screwed at all.
I know.
Yes, it's the university here. Yes, there are a lot of UNLV alumni and UNLV fans here. But at the end of the day, a lot of the people think, well, it's UNLV football. Like, I'll say this, not so much in Las Vegas, but definitely Raiders fans on Twitter that do not live in Las Vegas think UNLV should just be happy they get to play any games at Allegiant Stadium. like their thought process is UNLV shouldn't even be here, which is apparently the Raiders' thought process too. But like that's how they view this, that UNLV is just some crappy college football team that has no right to play any games there whatsoever. They should be thankful they get to play five next season.
Well, thankfully it isn't a publicly funded stadium.
Are you still on board the Raiders' playoffs hopes? Playoff hopes. Playoff hopes.
I don't know. There's a guy named Devlin out there winning games.
So 538 has five AFC teams with at least a 90% chance to make the playoffs. Baltimore, New England, Houston, and Kansas City as division winners, and Buffalo as a number one wild card team. And then the teams battling for the final wild card spot, Pittsburgh has a 46% chance to make the playoffs, Tennessee 42%, and the Raiders at 11%. The path for the Raiders to make the playoffs, it's this weekend. Like, it's as close to a must win as you can possibly have, because if they lose to the Titans, the Raiders would be two games behind the Titans with three to play, and the Titans would have the wild card. So if the Raiders lose to the Titans this week, the only way they can pass the Titans for a wild card spot is to win all three games while the Titans lose all three games. Now, the Titans do play Texans, Saints, Texans to end the year. So it is conceivable the Titans lose all three games after this game against the Raiders, but the Raiders still have to win all three of theirs, and that's very, very unlikely to happen. So you need to beat the Titans this week. A, that puts you level with the Titans, and you have the tiebreaker. So you'd be feeling pretty good about finishing ahead of the Titans, but then you still have to catch the Steelers. And the Steelers are one ahead of you in the playoff race right now. And they currently hold the tiebreaker because the Steelers and Raiders don't play, so the tiebreaker would come down to AFC record. It's conceivable that the AFC record would be the same if the Steelers and Raiders finish the season with the same exact record, and then you start getting down and you could eventually get to strength of victory as the tiebreaker that could decide the last AFC wildcard spot, which I think is what I'm cheering for.
Don't they win all their games by like 2 points?
No, no. So strength of victory is simply you take the teams you've beaten.
Oh, you take their schedule.
And you just add up their wins and losses.
Oh, okay. I like that.
That's all it is. And right now the Steelers would still win that tiebreaker. But that's what I'm hoping it comes down to, is strength of victory. Because it sounds ridiculous. Like, oh, the Steelers got the sixth wild card spot over the Raiders because their strength of victory was higher than the Raiders. Like, nobody even knows what that means, strength of victory. So I'm hoping that's what it comes down to. That's like tiebreaker number five, I think, on the list. So that's what I'm hopeful, is that the Raiders and Steelers finish tied and it comes down to strength of victory.
Oh, man. How does your season come down to Ryan Tannehill?
He's good.
It's weird.
He's good. He's a top 10 quarterback in the NFL right now.
What? Is that not incredibly infuriating?
No, watching it's great. It's the Titans with Ryan Tannehill.
Watching him all those years with the Dolphins just being inept.
Now he's great. Now he's got Derrick Henry running for 190 yards every week.
Devontae Parker, Jarvis Landry, and Kenny Stills. And that man could not find them. What he needed was a bunch of guys I've never heard of.
Yeah, he's got A.J. Brown, rookie from Ole Miss. Technically correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. The Orleans has a free rodeo event starting December 5th. That's tomorrow, running through December 15th. Orleans Arena is hosting All In Barrel Racing, which has free admission. It starts at 9 a.m. every day, so if you're looking for a cheap way to get into the rodeo, head to the Orleans Arena. It's technically correct, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
UNLV hired Ginny Ruiz-Williams to be the next
women's soccer coach, Ruiz.
Desiree Reed-Francois fired Chris Shaw after a 6-13-1 season. Ginny Ruiz-Williams actually played at UNLV back in the early 2000s. She has 2 years of experience as an assistant at the Division I level. So for trying to find trends, gain information on Desiree Reed-Francois' hires at UNLV to try to figure out what the next UNLV football hire will be, Ginny Ruiz-Williams is 36 years old. Desiree Reed-Francois has now made 4 hires. The oldest hire she made was TJ Otzelberger. He was 41 when he was hired. Christy Fox is the youngest. She was 31 when she was hired as the softball coach. Don Sullivan, I couldn't actually find her exact birthday. She's the volleyball coach. She was roughly 39 years old when she was hired. So Desiree Reed-Francois hires young, and she also hires coaches with little or no head coaching experience. Christy Fox, again, she was 31 when she was hired. She actually had the most Division I head coaching experience in her sport when hired. She had been the coach at UT Arlington for 5 years. Otzelberger, 3 years at South Dakota State. Don Sullivan had only been an assistant or associate head coach. And Ginny Ruiz-Williams has not been a head coach yet. So average age, 37 years old for Desiree Reed-Francois' hires at UNLV. Average head coaching experience is 2 years.
Okay, and I assume you put that through that calculator that's your brain, and you came up with a name.
Not a new one. I'm Kenny Dillingham.
Okay.
So the guy from Auburn, who's 29 years old.
He fits the profile.
I mean, he's too young.
we gotta stretch out this hiring period so that way we can hit his birthday.
Yes, we gotta wait for him to at least be 30.
Fresno State shoots the most threes in the country.
53% of their shots are threes. Highest rate in college basketball. The thing to watch for UNLV tonight is how they defend, because UNLV plays a pack line defense, and pack line defenses give up more threes. The goal of a pack line defense is to prevent layups and shots at the rim. The downside of that is that you give up more threes. That's part of the scheme that Otzelberger runs. So how many threes does Fresno State take, and how many of them do they hit in this game? Because they should get plenty. A, they're already looking to take a ton, and B, the way UNLV defends usually leads to more three-pointers. So that's sort of the biggest thing, I think, to watch defensively for UNLV tonight. On the other end, it's what we talk about the most, and it's layups. Get layups, finish layups. Cincinnati shut down driving lanes for UNLV. They forced UNLV to be a jump-shooting team. UNLV for the season now ranks 287th. In field goal percentage at the rim. They are making 55% of their layups. The college basketball average is around 62%. So, well, it's unfortunate. If they were just an average layup shooting team this year, they might be 6-3.
Oh, man.
But they're not. Fresno State, they've got some length, but they're not extremely long. They're kind of average. They're 6-3 at both spots in the backcourt, 6-5 at small forward, 6-8 at power forward. So there's some size there, but it's not like, oh, everybody's 6'6". You're totally screwed. They do block a lot of shots. They're top 100 in shot blocking this year. It shouldn't be 9 of 26 performance at the rim like UNLV had against Cincinnati, but it's not going to be as easy as, say, Purdue Fort Wayne or Abilene Christian or whoever. So can UNLV get a lot of layups, and can they actually finish those layups? It's the key to this game. It's probably the key to every game offensively this year.
I thought the issue was never them getting the layups. They get the layups, they just don't put them in.
Well, usually they get the layups, but Cincinnati completely took that away. So, I mean, they only got 26. I mean, Maury Hardy took, what was it, 17 threes?
Yeah.
Like, that's the main one. Is Hardy, they normally can get the layups because Hardy can normally get to the paint. He could not against Cincinnati, and he was forced to be a jump shooter in that game. Fresno State's not going to be as good defensively as Cincinnati. They shouldn't be able to take away the layups at that high of a rate, but they'll probably bother quite a lot of shots when UNLV does get there.
What rate are they hitting the threes at? They take the most?
I think they're pretty average. It's nothing extremely special. Actually, they're below average. They're 31%. National average is 33% this year.
So if they go ice cold tonight.
It could, yeah. They could absolutely just miss everything.
Game positive over here.
The Raiders practice facility will be named the Intermountain Healthcare Performance Center.
The what now? That sounds like an hospital. No, you got it right.
Oh, okay.
It sounds like an actual like physical therapy center.
Yes.
Intermountain Healthcare Performance Center. Which, is that better or worse than Lifeguard Arena?
I mean, better.
Yeah, I think so, too. Lifeguard Arena, if you're unaware, is the name of the new ice rink the Golden Knights are building in Henderson.
Why didn't they just go with Golden Knights Henderson?
I don't know. Would have actually somehow been better. I have a couple of questions.
Why didn't the Raiders go with
Oakland Raiders at Henderson?
Yeah.
Two questions, though, by the way, on this sponsorship. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit. How do nonprofits do naming rights deals? Because I'm assuming this is a multi-million dollar deal.
I don't know. How do convention authorities do naming rights
deals? Well, they get public money. We know that. They get tax money. And they spend it. But like this one, I genuinely don't know. Like, is that frowned upon? Is that just, oh, yeah, we're a nonprofit, but we're going to spend a couple million dollars every year to sponsor the Raiders? I genuinely don't know. The other part that I found weird, though, about this naming rights deal, Intermountain Healthcare is not in Nevada.
I'm sorry?
Intermountain Healthcare is not in Nevada. Now, they own a company that is in Nevada. It's called, like, Healthcare Partners of Nevada or something like that. So they do own something that's in Nevada, but they did not name the practice facility after what's actually in Nevada. They named it after something that doesn't exist in Nevada. So, like, if you drive by it and you're like, oh, Intermountain Healthcare, you can't even do anything with that. So, like, the people that are going to see it in Henderson, they're going to see Intermountain Healthcare, and if they were like, oh, I want to add that as my healthcare supplier, they can't.
Never mind. I can't get into that, but that is genuinely confusing.
Yeah, like we have two. So the Golden Knights and the Raiders are both building something in Henderson, and both of the naming rights deals, I'm like, that's not going to help you at all. Like Lifeguard Arena, I can't remember the name of the company, is for a company that sells like office supplies.
Yeah.
They just have some subsidiary that's called Lifeguard something. And they're like, ah, let's name it that. It's like, nobody's going to know. So very confused. Samford University had a study where they actually polled fans of Major League Baseball, NFL, and NBA. And they found that more than 50% of fans said they are not influenced at all by naming rights when it comes to actually purchasing things. Maybe all naming rights are useless regardless of what you actually name it. There was also Michael Leeds, a sports economist at Temple. He did a study and published a book or something. Maybe it was just a report titled A Stadium by Any Other Name, The Value of Naming Rights. And he examined 25 years of data and came to the conclusion that, quote, we find little evidence that the purchase of naming rights had a statistically significant impact on the value of the companies that bought them, and even less evidence that the impact was positive.
The only thing I can think of is the same reason that Coke advertises. Like, everybody knows Coke, but they advertise so that they keep their brand in your mind.
Yeah.
I have to assume the fact that T-Mobile is T-Mobile keeps the brand T-Mobile in your brain.
Yeah.
But you may have nothing, like, you'll never purchase a T-Mobile, but
at least I think about it.
Yeah.
The Golden Knights reassigned Garrett Sparks to the AHL.
He had been called up to back up Malcolm Subban because Marc-Andre Fleury was away from the team due to his father's passing. This could mean Marc-Andre Fleury is back tomorrow for the game in New York. If he is, I wonder if he plays.
Or it means Subban doesn't need a backup. He's his own backup.
He is a backup goalie. But he gets hurt a lot, so you don't want to not have a backup goalie. Fun fact, Malcolm Subban. Four straight games of giving up three goals or less. Marc-Andre Fleury has not done that this season.
What? How many wins in a row does Subban have?
Four. Fleury has also not done that this season either.
Has he even had three?
No.
Oh.
No. The Golden Knights did not have a three-game winning streak, period, as a team.
Man, something's different.
It is Derek Englund.
Is it?
Derek Englund has actually had, like, five chances or so over the last four games where he could have legitimately scored. He got an assist last night to Jonathan Marchessault. Like, Derek Englund has actually been like, oh, he could have scored right there. He's like had two breakaways.
So he's playing well on the other side?
Yeah, it's very strange. It's very strange.
But he's still a defensive liability?
I guess. He's now an offensive powerhouse, though. He's here to ruin everything.
At least he's doing something.
Yeah, so there's Derek Englund. He is the, I will give him credit. He is the, everybody accuses me of hating on Derek Englund simply because I want Jake Bischoff to play, which is probably true. That's fine. But Derek Englund is actually, like, contributing to the offensive side of hockey recently. It's very strange. Mike Grimal is going to join us next from Fresno. We'll find out why he thinks some UNLV and Nevada players should never play college football again.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Evolution.
No, I think I've had my taco.
Just your one. You've met your one taco quota for life.
Yeah, I did the taco. We don't need to go back there again. Have tacos changed that much since I tried one?
Tyler Bischoff is Technically Correct.
Mike Grimala joins us from Fresno. He has had one taco in his life. He's done with it. You did not eat Skyline Chili in Cincinnati. You've disappointed me.
I walked by it, though. I looked at it.
Yeah, you told me before you were going to do it so that we could ask you about it on the show, and then you didn't eat it.
Well, the issue was I was trying to get clarity on what exactly it is. Like, because I'm not familiar, like, chili. I'm not exactly sure what the components are, so I was asking around. I was asking, like, Kevin Bollinger from Fox 5 is usually my go-to guy. He explains food to me when we're on the road. But he was kind of like, it's kind of like a stew, but there's spices and there's meat. I was just like, what is chili? I wanted to say. And I couldn't get a straight answer to that, so I just kind of poked my head in and kept walking.
It would have been better. You could have eaten it and told us on air what you thought was in it.
It doesn't look that good. That's the thing. Like I
nothing
couldn't get it
good
down.
To you.
I know what I'm doing. Just trust me.
I don't think you do know what you're doing. All right, you're in Fresno now, which I don't think is known for any special food, so we won't criticize you for eating at Outback Steakhouse too many times. But can UNLV actually win a close game?
We haven't seen it yet against a quality opponent. But, they're in enough close games that you think eventually one is just going to break right for them. You know, they've gone to overtime against Kansas State. They went to overtime at Cal, overtime at Cincinnati. You think at one point, like, one of those late shots that bounces out is going to bounce in and you're going to win one. So if you keep putting yourself in that situation, you're bound to win one. But the problem is you don't want to win one on a fluke. You want to win them consistently because you're a good team and you sort of know how to play down the stretch in games, which is something that's been a theme at UNLV for years now. So they're still trying to figure out, I think, how to put it together at the end of games and start winning some of them.
You have a story up on the Sun kind of about close late games and UNLV's inability to win them. Like, what do you look at and say, oh, that's what needs to be different? That's why they're losing close games late.
Offense. For me, it's 100% offense. I know if you talk to the team, if you ask the players or the coaches, they like to say, you know, we've got to get stops and that will jumpstart our offense. And that kind of rings not so true. That's kind of like the company line, I think. Because they're getting enough stops where you can, like, they're not getting shredded, you know, in the stretch of these games. You know, opponents are shooting, I think, below 50% in the last 5 minutes of these close games. They're getting enough stops where it shouldn't be impacting their offense, where they just can't get a bucket. It's these offensive droughts that they go through. 7-8 minutes without a field goal every game, usually in the second half. Amori Hardy, the only guy who can really create any kind of offense. And so it's, for me, it's 100% about the offense. They can't score consistently enough to win these games down the stretch. When the other team, you know, you play hard for the entire game, but teams really ramp up their defense in the final minutes of a close game, and they're really contesting everything. And when they do that and when they put the clamps on, it just seems like UNLV doesn't have any answers.
So right now, UNLV, they are 158th in KenPom offensive adjusted efficiency. And I have, for the most part of the year, sort of blamed the offensive failures on the talent not quite being good enough for UNLV, that sometimes the offense just doesn't work because they can't penetrate and it comes down to, hey, Amori Hardy, here's a ball screen with 8 seconds left, do something. But at some point, like, there's got to be some sort of adjustment that works for TJ Altzelberger, even if his talent isn't as good as it needs to be to have a great offense. He's still got to get something for the offense to be better.
There's two things I would point to that adjustments that could be made. One is just injury. You're waiting for Jonah Antonio to come back. He's the one guy who knows how to play off the ball, where he can create some spacing. When Amari Hardy goes one-on-one, it's, you know, people say, oh, but the other four guys are just standing around. But they're not supposed to be just standing there. You know, they're supposed to be relocating, creating passing angles for him to kick the ball out. They're not supposed to be standing still. And Jonah Antonio is really the only guy, I think, who understands that. If someone else drives, and if his defender turns his head, he'll find a new spot, and he'll sort of create some space to get off a three-point shot. So you're waiting for him to get back to help the spacing a little bit. But the biggest thing, I think, is Donnie Tillman, who just hasn't really been what the team expected when they recruited him in the offseason. You expected, you know, with more minutes and a bigger role, sometimes, you know, he was a sixth man last year at Utah. Sometimes when you give him a bigger role, you get bigger production. Sometimes when you expand someone's role, they get exposed a little bit, and you see some of the flaws that were hidden by their limited minutes. I think that's what you're seeing with Tillman now, is that he maybe not be quite ready for that number two role. He's just having a tough time figuring out how to get his how to produce in this offense.
Well, UCLA and Cal, he had 17 and 16 in those two games, but it was 2 points or less against Kansas State or Cincinnati, and he didn't start the game against Cincinnati. He got benched in that game against Kansas State. Is there any thought to you that they just need to let him play? Like, he's fourth on the team in minutes right now. Like, Hardy and Elijah Mitrulong, TJ Altsenberger views those two guys as they can't come off the floor. They've got to play like 39 minutes every single night. Tillman's not at that level, but I kind of feel like this team, even if it's Tillman's late for something or whatever, they're better off if you just let him play, because he's going to be better than Nick Blair.
What does Donnie Tillman do well that you've seen so far? That is just forcing his way into these 36, 38 minutes a game.
Right. I'm not saying he has. I'm just saying the other options aren't doing anything either. Like, I've seen Tillman drive to the rim and score against UCLA. Nick Blair's not going to do that.
Yeah, but the thing is, I see Donnie Tillman do that every 25 minutes that he's on the floor. He's got a tendency to drift, I think. So if you play him for 20 minutes and you don't get much from him on a certain night, you could play him for 50 minutes that night and probably still get the same thing. I mean, I don't think it's going to snap for him on any given night. Some nights he's there, some nights he's not. That's what we've seen so far. I think maybe as he gets more comfortable, I think some of it's on the coaches. We've got to figure out how to use him and put him in position to be successful. But they've got to figure out a way to get more from him, or the offense is not going to get better, because the talent level is not there. There's only a select few guys on this team who have the offensive talent to score points consistently against a good defense. He's one of them, and if you're not getting anything from him, it's hard for everyone else to compensate, because no one else really has the ability to step up and compensate.
UNLV plays Fresno State. It's tonight at 7. You can hear it right here on ESPN Las Vegas. Want to switch to football with you. You think Austin Arnold and Giovanni Faolo should not play college football ever again?
College football is probably maybe a little too strong, because someone will take a chance on them if they transfer. Austin Arnold, for sure. I would assume he's going to be dismissed by Jay Norvell, just because the severity of that, the shot. Like, and there's some pretty good comparisons. I mean, you look at LeGarrette Blount, first game of the season, the exact same scenario. His team got beaten, an opponent ran by with a flip comment with no helmet on, and Blount sucker punched him in the face. And that was the first game of the season. And then, you know, next day Chip Kelly comes out, who I believe was a coach at the time, and suspended him for the year. So, and then I think Blount eventually went through a bunch of appeals and eventually got back on the field for the last game of the year. But, they were pretty – it's pretty clear-cut. If you do something that vicious, it's not in the heat of the moment. The game's over. The game has been concluded, and you just punch someone who doesn't have a helmet on, who's not looking. Yeah, you're probably not cut out to play college football. He's not going to play in their bowl game. I doubt he plays next year. And at that point, you probably just transfer and let some other coach at, you know, second chance you kind of take a – give you that other opportunity. Faolo it's bad timing for Giovanni Faolo, because UNLV's got a new coach coming in. And if the new coach comes in and his first act as the UNLV coach is to say, yeah, you swung your helmet at a spectator, but I'm going to look the other way on that and not discipline you, you're pretty much announcing to the team and to the program that, hey, I'm a total pushover, My discipline is completely limp. Do whatever you want. So Paolo kind of picked the wrong time to do something like that. The coach kind of has to come in and discipline him. So we'll see. It's not going to be light. It can't be light because that doesn't really have a place in sports to do stuff like that.
When's the right time to swing your helmet at a fan?
When you've got if you were going to a bowl game under Tony Sanchez and he was coming back and all the vibes were good, and Sanchez has a history with you, he recruited you, he named you a captain, your teammates love you, then maybe you get a second chance. And all this stuff is true for Paolo. He's, by all accounts, a great kid, team captain as a junior, great kid. So if the coach knows you and has a history with you, you probably got a better chance of surviving this. But otherwise, I don't think so.
What do you got for us on the next football coach? Who's it going to be?
I don't know.
Give us a name. What do you mean you don't know?
I don't know. Desiree Reed-Francois has not told me who she's going to hire. I know that she was not at the Cincinnati or Reno games last weekend because she's out on the trail trying to find a coach. That's pretty much all I can tell you. I haven't narrowed it down at all. I don't know if she's going old or young or previous head coach or up-and-coming assistant. I really can't tell you. It's very close to the vest.
Rank these in most likely to least likely: Jay Gruden, Ron Rivera, and Condoleezza Rice.
Most likely, Jay Gruden. Middle is Ron Rivera, and least likely is Condoleezza Rice.
Wow.
Because I don't think she has any previous football experience.
That doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. Get out of here.
Also, she does, so...
We got one suggestion from Don Sterling's right-hand arm man on Twitter. He says the Doghouse Grill is across the street from the Save Mart Center in Fresno. Best tri-tip sandwiches around. You going to go there?
I've heard that before. That's been recommended to me. I might do it for lunch.
All right. Thank you.
How about that?
Do it, and please report back to us.
What is tri-tip?
Well, you'll find out. You'll let us know tomorrow.
It's a steak, right?
You'll let us know tomorrow, Mike.
It's like steak.
Beef tenderloin.
He's Mike Cremala from the Las Vegas Sun. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
So, Mike Cremala, hopefully we'll find out what tri-tip sandwich is. One last thing on UNLV basketball. Does Otzelberger kind of need to win tonight?
I would be thoroughly impressed if they win tonight.
Thoroughly impressed?
I kind of am starting to think that this is going to work out like, I always invert it, Southern Texas.
Texas Southern.
Yes, I always invert it. Where you lose, like, you play a bunch of, like, non-conference games that you lose, and then once you get into conference, it's like, oh, okay, we can hang with these guys.
But this is a conference game.
I know.
So why would you be thoroughly impressed?
Because he's right in the middle. You're supposed to lose all the games at the beginning and then turn it around.
Very confusing point. Fresno State this year is only 2-4. They have a win over a non-D1 school and a win over Winthrop. They lost by one to Cal State Northridge, who is 232 in KenPom. They also lost in overtime to San Diego, who's 186 in KenPom. So Fresno State does not have a very good resume. Actually, a very similar resume to UNLV so far this year, because they've got a loss to Oregon on there as well. If you're UNLV, this is the game where you sort of declare no more moral victories. Like, this, no, there's no moral victory. If you lose this one in overtime, there's nothing good about that. Like, this is one you need to win. But for me, I think this one is important because it's a weird conference game this early in the season, and I think Otzelberger can sort of make up for some of the negativity early or have a good, you know, positive outlook going into year two if they do well in conference play. Like, if this team manages to get 11 conference wins and finish fourth, and every time they play Utah State, they lose by 4 instead of 17 or something like that, I think that can help. And Fresno State's one of the teams in the middle tier that you'll have to pass if you're going to go 11-7 and finish fourth. So to me, need to win's a very stupid phrase to use, but like, this one is, I think this is fairly important for the long term, or the year long picture of positivity in the Otzelberger year, because I think how they finish in Mountain West play is going to determine what we view the offseason going into year two for UNLV basketball.
Am I crazy because I want this to be a statement game?
Like, you want it to be a statement game for who? Vitaly Schiebel?
Checked it to belly. No. I want it to be a statement game because there's this weird break, I want teams that they have to play in the conference to be like, oh, crap. Did you just see what they did to Fresno? That's what I want. I want some sort of...
Well, the only problem with that is they won't play another conference game until January.
No, I know.
So nobody's going to be like, oh, crap, they did this a month ago.
All right, that's fair.
It is a very dumb schedule that the Mountain West is like, well, what is it, the concrete convention?
Is that what's going on?
I think it's the reason there's a conference game today for Mountain West schools is because they had to move two conference games up into December because they moved the Mountain West tournament up a week because there's some convention, and I think it's a concrete convention. And, like, room rates were ridiculously high, and we were like, the Mountain West is like, we don't want to pay that. We don't want our fans to have to pay that. Let's move it up. Everything will be cheaper. And I think it's a concrete convention. Coming up next, Jonathan Marchessault had a hat trick last night. Is he actually good? But hockey's just dumb is ultimately what the problem is.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler.
There's a twist on it.
He did.
A twist, and it's turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so close.
But it's still a stupid
joke. It's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just clever. A turnabout.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
Golden Knights beat the New Jersey Devils last night. Made sure Nikita Gusev didn't have a revenge game. Nikita Gusev, he played 14 minutes and 54 seconds last night. Recorded two shots on goal. He was a -1. He did have a 57% Corsi and a 61% expected goal percentage. So he was pretty good, except for missing a couple of chances. If he had scored last night against the Golden Knights, that would have been great. Would have been excellent. But
that would have been the whole show.
Yeah, so of course. Jonathan Marchessault, hat trick last night, again to prove that hockey is dumb. Hockey is the dumbest sport. Jonathan Marchessault had scored 3 goals in the entire month of November.
I literally came on here and went, what's wrong with Marchessault?
He scored 3 goals in the third period last night. In the month of November, Jonathan Marchessault had 43 scoring chances that were his, individually his. 43, he only managed to score 3 goals. Last night, he had 7 scoring chances. He scored 3 goals. So his conversion rate on scoring chances went from 7% to 43%. Hockey is dumb. The regression to the mean for Jonathan Marchessault happened all in one period. All at once.
That's not how math is supposed to work.
All right, now you score them all. Right now, okay, everything's fixed and everything's back to normal. Like, hockey is dumb. Like, seriously, like, he had the second most scoring chances on the Golden Knights last month. I think it was Max Pacioretty had more. Pacioretty scored 7 goals last month. Jonathan Marchessault scored 3. Like, it genuinely doesn't make sense that he only scored 3 goals last month. It also doesn't make sense that he scored 3 goals in one period last night. So at the end of the day, you look at it and you say, well, all right, everything's good. He's scoring at a normal rate now. But in reality, he did it all at once. Just all came at one time, and everything else is terrible. So the good news for the Golden Knights, though, conceivably, is that he did score. And, like, one of the biggest problems of the team so far is that he and William Karlsson have not produced high goal totals so far this season. It's been Riley Smith and Mark Stone is pretty much, and Max Pacioretty has pretty much been the only guys that have scored with any consistency. And even that, Riley Smith was hot early and has sort of trailed off a little bit. So they've been lacking from their top 6 any sort of consistent goal scoring, which ultimately is a problem when your third line hasn't given you very much at all and your fourth line is not there to score. Your fourth line is there to just simply keep the score 0-0 or keep the score at whatever it is and then
body some dudes.
Yeah, get off the ice and hope that Mark Stone can go score for you. So the Golden Knights are reliant. They are reliant on their top 6. Now, Alex Tuch, Cody Glass will carry it together. Maybe that gives them somewhat of a formidable third line. Like, you're hopeful that they can get a third line that is productive. But at the end of the day, the Golden Knights are going to make the playoffs, win the Pacific Division, win a playoff series, win multiple playoff series, whatever it is. They're going to do it because the top 6 is really good. They're not going to do it because they get goal scoring from the fourth line. They're not going to do it because they get goal scoring from their defensemen. They're going to do it because the top 6 is really good and they manage to not give up many goals because they play well defensively or in their own zone defensively and their goaltending is good. Like, that's how they win. So getting Jonathan Marchessault scoring is excellent. The problem is he scored 3-1 period, and the way hockey works is he might not score for another month. It just might not happen, and then he'll have 7 over the span of 3 games, and oh, look, everything's fixed again.
Did you just admit to listening to Tyler's show?